Oh, good morning, welcome. It's Sohill's Community Radio and the Community Hour on Monday. And as the series goes on, I welcome my fifth band of brother, Ian Arthur from Dundee. Good morning, Ian.
Good morning, Dave.
How are you doing? All right?
Yeah, good, thanks. It's a beautiful day.
Excellent. Yeah, thanks for joining me. This is a slightly different slant on the band of brothers, isn't it? A, you're still in Dundee, which is unusual. And B, well, you tell me about it.
Well, as you say, I'm a bit of an outlier in the band of brothers, a little bit outside the core. The core group all, of course, knew each other from school and growing up. And I'm a little bit different in that I've been invited in by Stuart's brother, Gary, to join the group. I've known Gary for a little while now and go walking with him. And being a doctor, a GP, it seemed an ideal fit to you know, join in for this campaign for awareness and money raising for Prostate Cancer UK.
Yeah, and that explains my second question, why the nickname Band-Aid?
Ah, well, we had a little bit of a competition. And, you know, I can't remember who came up, which one of the band of brothers came up with the Band-Aid term. There were a few other suggestions, but I thought Band-Aid fitted quite well, you know. It's obviously it's a sticking plaster. And, you know, I'm there to give first aid to the band of brothers. And Band-Aid seemed to, yeah, be a good result.
And you are the youngest, are you, of the band?
I think I'm the youngest. There might be one slightly younger, right. But I'm 58. So, yeah, I'm not a spring chicken. But
you're giving 10 years or so on a lot of them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think Ian Crichton's the oldest. I'm sure he won't mind me telling him that, but telling the world that. He's the oldest. He's 10 years older than me. And as you know, most of the others are around 65 mark. So we all add up to over 1,000. And, you know, that's the other name for the band of brothers. It's the 1,000-year hike that we're going on.
Yeah, Ian Crichton, yeah, Ash did. That's
that's his nickname, yeah.
So you didn't actually meet Stuart.
No.
But obviously, knowing Gary so well, you must have heard quite a bit about him.
Gary spoke about him when Stuart was ill. And, you know, obviously Stuart was, you know, got quite ill quite quickly. So, you know, Gary mentioned that and, you know, was obviously quite distressed by it and was visiting his brother, you know, and Gary's got a lot of friends, you know. Yeah, Gary's a well-known, well-connected person with a lot of friends, and he's happy to share his story and talk to people.
Yeah. And how long have you been in Dundee then?
I moved to Dundee in 1993. Okay. So 29
long
years,
time, yeah,
something why, like that, yeah.
Why?
Why Dundee?
Yeah.
Dundee is a beautiful place now. It was a little bit different in 93. A little bit more, I would say, run down, but there's been so much investment in the city, especially in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
Improvements in, you know, leisure, amenities, housing, just the general environment, everything is improving so much. And that probably goes for most cities in the UK. Yeah. Certainly when I go to places that I haven't been to for a long time, you notice massive differences.
That's right. We would say in the south of the UK that that's where all our money's gone over the last 20 years.
And up to the north.
Up to the north, yeah, including my hometown in the Midlands.
Okay.
I noticed the difference there, but it's great. I mean, that's, we should share it. Sorry, carry on.
I was going to say, just carrying on from, you know, cities that change, you know, I did spend a little bit of time working outside of, you know, Scotland, up in the north. And, you know, and my wife, you know, she went to university in Leeds. So I've been back there a couple of times. And the difference in a town like Leeds from the late 80s or mid 80s when she was at university to now, it's just night and day. So yeah, your money is going northwards, but you know, that's just how things even out in the world, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you can tell when things are improving because youngsters want to go to university in Leeds and places like that where, you know, perhaps 30, 40 years ago, you didn't get the choice, but also would you have chosen that? I don't know. Good news. Yeah. So you're going to be the go-to person on about day three when the blisters start appearing and stuff like that.
Well, I might be the go-to person after the first hour, you know. We might be still in Glasgow.
Assessing them all beforehand?
I say that they've all very generously shared some of their health history. I know Derek that you had on last week has had his two knee replacements. You know, some of the others have got some issues.
At our ages, we're bound to, aren't we?
We're bound to. Yeah. But you know, no one's putting themselves at risk, as far as I know, for doing the walk. You know, there's always the opportunity to stop, although the drive is really there to complete it. So we just have to watch out for people who are perhaps pushing themselves when they shouldn't do, when they need a rest day. Mm. You know, if the knees are particularly bad or the feet are particularly blistered.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, it's not no shame, is it, to get that? I mean, it's what happens. You're either lucky or you're unlucky with blisters and things. And they are painful, aren't they?
Well, they are.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, we talk about in kind of hill walking and climbing, there's always this thing spoken about as summit fever. So when you're climbing a hill, you get blinkered vision that you must reach the summit. So this is summit fever. And, you know, against logical or sensible advice to turn back because the weather's terrible, you're not feeling well, you've got an injury. People, you know, just try to push themselves, you know, to reach that summit. So we will watch out for that, but everybody will watch out for each other on the walk.
Yeah.
People do know each other. I've got to know the Scottish contingent, if you like, the local residents for the Band of Brothers. There's about five or so of us still up here. Obviously, I haven't met any of the people who are coming from overseas, Switzerland, Singapore, Canada. Neil has come up from London a few times to do walks. He's coming up again quite soon.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that, yeah.
Yeah. So overall, everybody that I've met so far has been very welcoming. You know, I think it's a good thing to extend the Band of Brothers a little bit outwards. And, you know, that's possibly a move for the future as well. It could be a fluid, dynamic group of people. Also, obviously, based on that original core of, you know, doing something good for everyone in memory of Stuart.
Yeah, I asked Derek, I think it was last week, would he continue with it? Would he want to continue with it? And he was quite enthusiastic about that.
Yeah, yeah.
So that would be, you know, it's a good sign. And it will grow, won't it?
I think so. We'll see how it goes on the walk. It might be the end of the walk. We've had quite enough. It's one thing to go for a day walk, but day after day after day after day,
yeah.
You know, people might get a little bit grumpy. You know, they might be tired and sore, and they might be wanting home to their own bed and a nice soft pillow.
Do you come in there as well?
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Can you offer spiritual advice and sort of...
I could do. I'm not a psychologist, but, you know, I'll give encouragement and, you know, try and keep folk along. But, you know, as I say, the band are all encouraging. You know, the walks that I've done so far and training walks, everybody's helped each other. And we've done one or two quite tough walks already, long walks over kind of rough terrain up in the northwest of Scotland. And, you know, it's training. Training, you probably have to train harder for a day walk than the continuous multi-day walks, because it's the cumulative effect over the multiple days that will really take its toll on your joints.
Yeah. So you're, without being overconfident, you're fairly confident you'll be okay.
Well, I don't want to, you know, no. have, have, because, you know, pride comes before a fall.
It will come back and bite you, yes.
It will do, but if all goes well, I'm confident that I've got the fitness levels. I might hobble a little bit with my sore foot, but I've got the fitness levels, generally speaking, to complete. As long as there's no accidents, anyone can twist their ankle, anyone can fall down over a little slippy bit of rock if it's raining, and, you know, you've bashed your hip or your leg or your elbow. Nobody can guarantee it, but I think everybody's given themselves the best possible chance. We're all taking it quite seriously, you know, with all the training walks, with the general fitness. I think there's been, I don't have before and after weights for the group. But we might do a little survey and see, you know, how many stones we've lost.
I would guarantee they've training. Weighed themselves. I guarantee they've weighed themselves.
Yeah, they probably have. Yeah. So we'll see what they were before they started training, and we'll maybe do a little survey on how much they weigh at the start of the walk and the end of the walk. End of the walk, they might weigh more. I've certainly got a full breakfast every day booked to keep us going. So that might actually slow us down and, you know, clog up the old circulation, but we'll do what we can.
And the weather, have you checked the long range weather forecasts?
No. You know,
isn't the end of May normally okay on the West Coast, or as best as it can
I've had Spain? Sleet in June in Scotland.
Okay, right.
You know, so you just never truly know. I'm quite hopeful. What we really need is dry. You know, it doesn't matter if it's cold, because you just put on more clothes. But if it's wet for the whole day, then no matter how good your waterproofs are, how good your boots are, water's going to seep through. Water's going to get down your neck. Water's going to get everywhere. Yeah. And that's miserable. But, you know, we're lucky we're staying in some bed and breakfasts and not in tents. I think we're beyond the tent age group. A lot of people who do the West Highland Way obviously camp every night and carry their tent and their food and their stove on their back. But I don't think we could cope with that. It'd
be like an episode of MASH, wouldn't it, if you did?
It would be. Sure. I really think there would be an ambulance to drive behind us the whole route to pick up the stragglers, probably including me.
I suppose at least in May, if I'm right, you don't get the gnats or anything like that, do you?
I think they would have started, but, you know, the warmer the weather and into June, July and August, that's when the midges really start. Mm. And the midges are worse the further west and north you go. So we're not in terrible midgy country, but, you know, they are there. But hopefully they'll be quite tame at that time of year. And,
you're a retired GP. Have you heard any really bad news stories about midges and things? Because we hear a lot of it down here, and people say, don't go in August to Scotland, certainly on the West Coast, don't do this. Don't. And I'm thinking, surely it can't be any worse than, I don't know, Greece or...
Greece is the mosquitoes. And, you know, I have seen some horrendous looking bites and stuff from people coming back from holiday in southern Europe.
Yeah.
You know, huge blisters the size of a golf ball, literally on legs. So mosquitoes can be nasty. Midges, they're so small, you can hardly see them. But there are a huge number of them. Mm. And they find you wherever you are. I think they detect carbon dioxide in your breath of animals, and they kind of home in on that. So I have been camping in Scotland before where I have bailed out and gone home because the midges were an inch thick on the surface of the tent when I've got out in the morning. So there are places and there are times of years when it's worse than others, but this year is forecast to be a high volume of midges. So I'm not doing very well for the Scottish Tourist Board.
No, not at all. No, we're up there next week, I think, for a week. So I'm getting it in beforehand.
Stay out of the forests. You know, but just buy some midge repellent. There's lots and lots of them out there, some natural, some artificial chemicals.
I was going to ask you that. Do they work? You can say that now as a retired GP.
Certainly the ones containing DEET, which is your standard insect repellent that you get in all the mosquito repellents as well. So DEET, it's got a long chemical name, but that's what it's shortened to. And, you know, if it contains DEET, it generally works. They don't smell nice. They're not like Chanel number 5 or whichever. So they're not popular with people because, you know, they just smell of chemicals. But if everybody's got the mosquito repellent on, you're all in the same boat. And it covers up the camping smells if you haven't had a shower for 3 days. So it's got its advantages.
So I rarely get the joy of a GP on air to talk about things, but this is a very serious matter, really, isn't it? Looking over beyond the walk, prostate cancer has been in the news for years, but it's never really, in my view, been taken that seriously. Correct me if I'm wrong. But it's starting to now, I think, isn't it?
It is starting to. I mean, there's always been, you know, research into cancers in general, so Cancer Research UK. And then there's specific research for specific cancers. So Prostate Cancer UK is who we're walking for to raise money. And, you know, they'll contribute towards research programs and education and public health campaigns. But mostly the focus is on research, and that's where most of the money goes. And, you know, there's no doubt that prostate cancer needs more research. When you compare it to other cancers, perhaps, say, breast cancer, cervical cancer, colon cancer, they all have national screening programs, which everybody's invited into. And prostate cancer doesn't have a national screening program. Now, that's specifically because there isn't a good enough test to use as a screening test for prostate cancer for the general population.
Okay.
There's a drive to find a test. You know, even in the news yesterday, there was another article about finding certain bacteria in the urine that might predict your risk of high-grade prostate cancer in the future. Other research going on into detecting early cases of all types of cancer, including prostate cancer, lung cancer, etc. With all cancers, the earlier you diagnose them, the better the outcome. So if you diagnose at an early stage, you've got more treatment options and, you know, a better survival rate. You know, if you look at the number of people who survive 5 or 10 years, the percentage is higher the earlier you diagnose a cancer. So, you know, there's a drive to find people early on, find the ones who've got aggressive cancer, because some people with very early stage cancer don't need surgery or radiotherapy. Very early stages, a proportion of people will just need active surveillance. So just monitoring of their PSA blood test every so often, and waiting to see if it starts to grow, and then do treatment at that point. On the other hand, roughly about 20% of people with prostate cancer are diagnosed at stage 4, and that's obviously the highest stage, the most advanced stage, when they're spread beyond the prostate. And the survival rate for prostate cancer stage 4 at diagnosis is much, 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 much lower, roughly about 45% to 50%, as compared to stage 1 and 2, where the survival rate for 5 years is actually 100%. There'll be a few people die, but rounding to the nearest whole percentage point, it's virtually 100% survival rate for early cancer. And, you know, so there's a drive by Prostate Cancer UK to encourage people to be aware of their prostate risk and to have some testing if they want to have testing done. And for that, they just need to see their GP or speak to their GP.
Can I stop you there, Ian? Because that varies region to region.
It shouldn't really do.
I know, but it does. I was talking to, say, Derek, who gets regular checks, albeit blood tests. I'll ask your opinion on the difference in a minute, but I had one about 2 months ago because I'm just on the fringe of diabetes, you know.
Okay.
Because I'm overweight, probably. But and they do the prostate check as well. But the doctor said to me, they'd had a thing down from NHS to say that you're not supposed to do them unless there are symptoms. Now, I thought always, as you said, prevention is better than cure. But that's a Sussex view, because where I live now, in Surrey, I'm not even sure you can get to see a GP at the moment. It's that bad. But in Hertfordshire, where Derek's from, it's a matter of course. So it does seem to be, it varies around the country. I said Scotland is fine. Yeah.
Well, most of the figures that we have come from NHS England and Wales, in actual fact. I don't have figures for Scotland. So in terms of diagnosis and numbers, it's NHS England and Wales figures that are that Prostate Cancer UK is promoting. NHS England have the Prostate Cancer Risk Management Programme, which says specific to England and Wales. It doesn't apply in Scotland, but you know, the information is freely there and you can link to it on the Prostate Cancer UK website. But the Prostate Cancer Risk Management Programme has really been going since about 2015. And in conjunction with NICE, which is the kind of standard setting body for NHS England and Wales, although the guidance we still use in Scotland, so it applies to everyone. So National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence,
again,
NICE.
Sorry, and again, why not Scotland?
The NHS Scotland is it's just a devolved power. So health is devolved to the Scottish Government, and therefore NHS Scotland has their own agenda. For instance, they create broadly similar programmes, but there are subtle differences. Everyone knows that Scotland has the poorest health of the four nations. So we do have our specific problems up here. It's probably related to diet, exercise, smoking, alcohol, all the usual things that lead to premature death. So they're all priorities for NHS Scotland, as in England. But we don't have a specific prostate cancer management, risk management programme in Scotland, but we still have what are called the Scottish guideline referrals for cancer. So there are a list of symptoms, if you like, where we would refer people for the standard 2-week appointment with a specialist, same as you have in England. Screening programmes, we have the same in Scotland, so breast, cervical, bowel, all there. There's not a screening programme anywhere for lung cancer. There's not for pancreatic cancer, stomach cancer. There's loads of cancers there's no screening programme for, and there's none for prostate cancer. So for prostate cancer, we do have a blood test. So prostate-specific antigen, PSA, is the blood test that can be raised in prostate disease. So any kind of prostate disease will raise your PSA. And the question is, should you have a PSA blood test or should you not have one? And the risk management program, which is supported by NICE as well, does specifically say that if you're over 50 in England and Wales, but it applies to Scotland equally and Northern Ireland, if you're over 50 and you want to know your prostate risk, you can speak to your GP or another healthcare professional who may be nominated by the practice to be an expert in that field. It may be an advanced nurse practitioner, for instance. And, you know, you can discuss your risk. Your risk is affected by things like your family history. So we know that if you have a brother or a father who has prostate cancer, you're 2.5 times more likely to develop it yourself during your lifetime. Now, it's obviously, if you've got a cousin or a grandfather, there may be a slightly increased risk, but it's not as high an increase or multiplier as the 2.5 for a first degree relative, brother and father. We know if you're a black man, then you've got roughly twice the risk of prostate cancer in your lifetime, 1 in 4 chance compared to 1 in 8 chance for the white population. So, you know, if you're in a position where you've got a family member with prostate cancer and, you know, for instance, if you're aged even 45 or over, you're black and you have a father who had prostate cancer, you'd be eligible for a PSA check and a digital rectal examination to feel the prostate if you wanted one. Now, like all screening tests and all tests looking for a disease, there's a percentage of people who take that up and a percentage of people who just don't. For instance, I keep talking about the bowel screening program where you get, you know, you send your poo test off looking for blood in it from age 50 onwards every 2 years. Now, that has an uptake of only about 50%. So roughly half the population who are eligible for the screening just decide, well, I'm not going to do it. And of course, they're just burying their head in the sand. And it may come back to haunt them later and they say, oh, I wish I had taken the test. So that goes for all screening programs. There's lots of people who take up the offer and lots of people who don't. So Prostate Cancer UK are trying to find people, everybody who's at risk of prostate cancer, to go and speak about their risk. And the fundamental reason behind this is the pandemic, because we know that in 2019, just before the pandemic, around 53,000 people were diagnosed with prostate cancer in England and Wales. And there'll be a similar percentage, 10% of that, and it would be Scotland, 10%, roughly 9% of the population. And then during the first sort of 3 months of the pandemic, the number of people diagnosed obviously dramatically dropped, because not all GP practices were running a telephone only, a closed door policy. Nobody could get routine appointments or testing. Now, overall, in the first year of the pandemic, the number of people diagnosed with prostate cancer dropped by roughly 14,000. So there are these 14,000 men out there who should have been diagnosed with prostate cancer in the first year of the pandemic, 2020, who weren't. There's been a little bit of a catch-up since in 2021. We don't have figures for prostate cancer specifically in 2021 that I'm aware of, but some cancers, like breast cancer, have caught up in the numbers in lung cancer, the catch-up, and the numbers diagnosed have kind of rebounded. But prostate cancer has still got fewer people in treatment than they should do, and that treatment gap is what we're trying to narrow. So prostate cancer seems to be kind of unique in that regard. Whilst the other cancers seem to be catching up, prostate cancer really isn't. So if you are over 50 and you have read the information on the pros and cons of the PSA blood test on the Prostate Cancer UK website, you know, there's links there to it. If you've read it, you understand it, you realise that you could be put through tests which are unnecessary and could lead to some side effects and discomfort. If you realise that you could pick up a very early cancer, which may actually be very low grade and might not need specific treatment, you could end up just being overtreated and have surgery unnecessarily. Although I say the policy now for some very sort of the less aggressive prostate cancers is to watch them and monitor them, active surveillance, as I mentioned before. So if you think you're at risk, you're over 45 and you've got a close family relative, or you're black, if you're over 50, even if you don't have a family member with prostate cancer, you still have a risk of 1 in 8 in your lifetime of developing prostate cancer. And if you say, I'm happy to take the risk of side effects and overdiagnosis, I just want to have my test done, then your GP should not refuse you. Now, and
there's overdiagnosis, is that something that happens?
Yeah, it does happen. Yeah, I mean, I, again, it's a known problem with you know, any condition, if you like. When we've always had the general attitude that prostate cancer is staggered into a kind of series of aggressiveness measurements, if you like. So on the biopsy and with your scans, etc., you know, your oncologist or urologist would say, okay, you've got what looks like a cancer which is just going to be extremely slow growing. It's not likely to spread or cause you any great difficulty in the near future. You know, you're already 85. You know, I think you should just do nothing. Okay. Now, it's clearly very different to have someone aged 54 who has a very aggressive cancer, or someone aged 65 with a very aggressive cancer, those people obviously need treatment immediately. So, but we won't know who's in the group who have got what we call indolent cancers, which are not going to cause trouble, until you actually do the tests and do the biopsies and look at the scoring system for the appearance under the microscope. So it's an extremely complicated field as to what treatment any one individual person needs. Prostate Cancer UK on their website do have quite a lot of educational material for GPs. And this big campaign that they've been running, you know, would have penetrated to every medical practice in the UK. So, you know, regional health authorities in England don't have the right to say we are not doing that test as a blanket policy for our area. It's where you'll find the variation is actually in individual GPs. So you may find an individual GP has made a decision, I don't believe that the prostate specific antigen blood test should be done in people with no symptoms. And they might just say, well, I'm not doing it. I'm okay. Telling you, you shouldn't do it. But if that's the case, and we know there will be that response from a proportion of GPs, if that's the case, then, you know, Prostate Cancer UK on their website have an information sheet to show to your GP and discuss it. Your GP should listen to your concerns. And if you understand what the test is all about and its limitations, then you want it, then you can have the test. There are limitations with PSA blood test, as I mentioned. For instance, most people with a raised PSA blood test level will not have prostate cancer. They'll just have a benign enlargement of the prostate or some other condition. And also, maybe more worryingly, a proportion of people with prostate cancer will have a normal PSA blood test. So prostate cancer doesn't always cause the PSA blood test to rise. There's a proportion of people where it's very low or just borderline. And when they go through their test, you find they're already at stage four. So that's the difficulties with interpreting a blood test like PSA. We need a better test. I'm hoping for one to come along soon. You know, I'm always hoping for, you know, better treatments for cancer, better diagnosis for cancer. Because we're all at risk, you know. We're all, I'm late 50s, but, you know, as you get older into your 60s, 70s, 80s, cancers of all kind become more common with age. So sooner things improve for research and development, the better from my point of view.
Yeah. Does it cost more, do you think, to treat them than it does to research the prevention of it? I mean, it must be a tricky question, but, you know, surely stopping it is a lot cheaper.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't think we'd ever be able to prevent prostate cancer per se, because we don't particularly know what's the cause of it. So some cancers are preventable to a certain extent. Let's take lung cancer. Roughly about 70% of lung cancer could be prevented, and about 30% couldn't, because we all think lung cancer is only to do with smoking, but it's not. There are people who get lung cancer who have never smoked, and there are different types of lung cancer. So lung cancer, if we still stop, if the whole country stopped smoking 40 years ago, we'd probably have only about 30% of the lung cancers that we currently have, because 70% would have been prevented. But we don't know how to prevent prostate cancer. If we identify people early at stage one and two, and then identify the aggressiveness of their particular tumour that they have, you can then tailor the treatment to that individual person. And if the person has got stage one cancer, stage two cancer, and it looks aggressive under the microscope, then you could have radical prostatectomy, so surgery to remove the whole prostate and the surrounding tissues, or you could have radiotherapy. And those are likely to give you virtually a guaranteed cure. You know, your 5-year survival rate would be 100%, you know, just about. Okay.
I'm told Stuart was pretty unlucky with his prostate cancer.
he clearly had a very aggressive disease, and you know, he presented with back pain, I believe, at stage four. So, you know, it's impossible to turn the clock back and say, you know, there might have been some way of detecting it earlier, but we know that if we had a better test and a screening program from age 45, for instance, we would detect these things early.
Is it all down to money?
Well, it's down to money. It's down to money, but we still need to find the scientists to come up with the test. Okay, I mean there is research going on into cancers and early detection of all cancers all over the world, and there's a crossover in techniques from one type of cancer to another. So one detection method may apply to other cancers, for instance, and one type of treatment may apply to others as well. You know, even if you do have a diagnosis at a later stage, and I'm conscious that if people are listening who have advanced prostate cancer or know someone who has it, you know, all is not lost. There are treatments out there which work some of the time, you know, roughly about 50% of the time, you know. So the survival rate for stage four cancer at diagnosis is obviously less than 100%, but it's roughly 50% at 5 years. So you've still got a chance of keeping the cancer at bay. You can never get a full cure from that level of spread of disease, but there are drugs that are coming along and have come along in the last 5 to 10 years, which can just hold it in check. You know, just make it dormant, if you like. So it's still there, but it's not actively growing and spreading. It's just been, you know, put into a suspended in an animation state, the tumor, if you like.
And so what happens about the 14,000 people that we've lost effectively, haven't we, somewhere?
My feeling is that it will rebound back, okay? But if it rebounds back too late, say 3, 4, 5 years from now, there'll be a higher proportion of people who are presenting at a later stage. Okay. So we already know, it's not statistically significant, but we already know that in 2021, so the second year of the pandemic, for instance, the percentage of people with more advanced stage four cancer at diagnosis rose from about 17% before the pandemic up to about 21%. So one in five roughly are presenting at stage four, and obviously four and five are presenting at younger, earlier stages. So if we can bring these people in sooner rather than later, they would probably, on average, if you're talking about thousands of men, on average, there would be an earlier stage of their disease, and earlier you can stage the disease and work out what the best treatment is, the better the outcome you have. So I think those people will eventually come forward, but we don't want them to come forward in 5 years' time with stage four cancer. We want them to come forward sooner rather than later.
Well, it's all scary, isn't it, really?
Well, it is scary, but as I say, on the good side, if you look at prostate cancer as a whole, you know, you've still got roughly about 80% survival rate at 10 years. So it's not, you know, it's not all doom and gloom. There is reason to be diagnosed, and there is reason to be diagnosed early. The worst situation is just obviously to ignore it until it's too late. And, you know, people should be reassured that if they, you know, if they come forward, they get tested, they need to have some more, a biopsy or an MRI scan. They need to have their condition staged. They make a choice of their treatment in conjunction with their oncologist. And, you know, they can be confident that whatever stage of cancer they're at, there will be some treatment that can be offered. Not always successful, obviously. But, you know, the number of people who are dying from prostate cancer every year is actually dropping a little bit. The number of people being diagnosed is going up each year, but the number of people who are being, who are dying from it is going down. many older people, you know, you die with your prostate cancer rather than because of it. But for younger people, as I mentioned, and for, so, you know, people under, say, 80, it's a different story altogether, especially if you're, you know, if you're fit and healthy 75-year-old, you would be getting full active treatment. You know, there's no ageism as such. It's an individual decision with your own oncologist about what treatments you want to have.
Well, Ian, I could talk forever with you. We're well over the normal time. We've been speaking for twice as long as we normally do, but it's been fascinating stuff. And yeah, I'd love to talk to you again about it all, especially after the walk, just to see how the minor injuries clinic went.
I'll need to pack my sticking plasters.
Yeah. So thank you, Ian. That's retired GP now, aren't you? Although you're still obviously working.
I've retired from my own practice. So I'm no longer a partner in a practice. I retired last October. Got my pension, all that sort of thing, but I'm still working. There's obviously, as everyone knows, terrible access problems to GPs just now. It's no different in Scotland as it is to the south of England, to the Midlands, to the north of England. It's the same all over.
Right.
You know, in my practice, they haven't been able to find a GP to replace me yet. So it's just working on sort of locums. The practice I'm working in at the moment, I'm doing one or two days per week to try and keep them afloat for the next 2 months, but they're highly likely to close, and that's a country practice, you know, serving just a population of about near just under 4,000, and there's no nearby practice, but the practice is likely to close because there's just only one doctor left, and she's at retirement age, and there's no one to replace her. So it's an absolute disaster, which has been decades in the making. I'm not going to get political, but...
Well, not this time. But.
all political parties over the last 15 to 20 years have just, depending on, it'll be fine, and there's not been enough workforce planning, because doctors don't come about overnight. You have to pay, or the taxpayer has to put them through medical school for 5 or 6 years and another 5 or 6 years training on top of that to be a GP. So it takes time, and it's been neglected, unfortunately.
As you say, it's not political, is it? Because it's every party. Any party that's ever been in power.
But, exactly. You know, but we've got other priorities as well as health. There's social policy as well, and you know, social care policy has as big an effect on people's health and well-being as the medicines that we prescribe. So we need to spread the money everywhere. So, but obviously, as a GP, I'm just looking at it in a blinkered way from from the health perspective. But social care, that's another series for your video show.
Thank goodness you're looking at it. So thanks, Ian, for telling us the actual reason that Stu's band of brothers are punishing themselves for the end of May. And that's... One or two have said to me, it's for prostate cancer awareness. It's not just the money, although the money is important, but it's to make everybody aware of what goes, of what's happening.
Exactly. And we're grateful for, you know, the opportunity to spread the word on your show.
Yeah. Well, I hope you're not too busy over the 1,000-year hike. what can I say? Are you having to carry all your medical equipment with you?
My medical equipment, I think I haven't got it a proper kit list yet, but I think it'll be more or less just a couple of sticky plasters and a hip flask of whiskey. And I love Scotland. I think that'll keep them going.
Excellent. Thanks very much for your time, Ian. Lovely to talk to you.
You're welcome.
Speak to you soon.